This is a reading of the lecture cycle, The Apocalypse of St. John, by Rudolf Steiner. This is lecture 6, given in Nuremberg on the 23rd of June, 1908. In material science, it is customary, with the exception of a few circles who have recently come to a different explanation, to represent our present solar system as having developed out of a kind of nebula, which embraced a space that reached beyond the orbit of Neptune, that is, the orbit of the outermost planet of our solar system. And then, it is supposed, through a condensing process, our sun and the planets, moving round it, gradually formed. As we have said, there are now a few exponents who have a somewhat different view. But they, too, do not bring forward anything essential for us who take a spiritual view. So our sun and the planets circling round it are supposed to have formed themselves into spheres. In connection with this, a neat comparison has always been made use of in schools, and it is still employed today, to demonstrate how a whole planetary system can originate through rotation. Some oily liquid is taken, which, when placed in water, takes on a spherical form. Then a small disk is cut and inserted through the equatorial line of this oily ball, so that it is divided into two halves. This is then rotated by means of a pin stuck through the center of the disk. And one sees at first one drop separate itself and circle as a separate body round the large sphere, then a second and a third drop, and finally a large drop remains in the center, around which many smaller ones revolve. The experimenter says, "A planetary system in miniature." Then he says, "Why should not our solar system originate from that primeval nebula in this way, if we can now imitate it in this miniature solar system?" Usually this comparison seems to be extremely convincing, and people now understand how, once upon a time, Saturn, Jupiter, Mars, Earth, Venus, Mercury separated from that primeval nebula. But the whole affair, not only the comparison, but the whole idea, proceeds from the emptiness of all present-day thinking. For the persons in question, otherwise quite learned men, who put forward this illustration in such a convincing manner, forget only one thing, namely that they themselves are present and turn the pin. Now, self-forgetfulness is very good in certain realms of life, but in this case, if the experimenter is forgotten, the most important thing is forgotten, for without him the drop of oil would never rotate at all. The learned person who believes in such a superstition — this superstition is called the Kant-Laplace system — should at least be logical in his thinking. He should at least presume that some sort of being must have sat on a gigantic stool in space at that time and set the gigantic axis in motion. But human thought has gradually become so accustomed to consider only the material that the contradiction in such a comparison is no longer noticed. As a matter of fact, there is a certain truth in this so-called Kant-Laplace system, although the truth is different from the materialistic explanation of the matter. There is a certain truth in it, because to spiritual vision, everything contained in our present solar system does indeed appear as having proceeded from such a primeval nebula. Only to him who can really investigate historically is it clear that the good in the Kant-Laplace hypothesis comes from the occult traditions. This was forgotten when the word, quote, occultism, close quote, became something of which one was afraid, as children are afraid of the boogeyman. But what really took place when our solar system was formed did not happen without the influence of spiritual beings and powers. Matter can do nothing unless spiritual beings are behind it. It would take us too far today if, linking on to what was said yesterday, we were to explain the whole of our solar system, leaving the planets such as Jupiter, Saturn, and so on out of our present study. Let us only keep in mind what is of special importance to the life and evolution of mankind. At one time there was, in fact, such a nebula, and in this all the parts of our solar system were as if dissolved, but bound up with this nebula, so that they belonged to it, were all the beings mentioned in the course of our observations yesterday. For example, all the beings who passed through the human stage in the 24 rounds were connected with this cosmic nebula. Other beings, too, were bound up with it. They all dwelt in this primeval nebula, which, if not thought of in connection with these beings, is a fantastic abstraction. The idea the materialistic chemist has of this nebula is an impossibility. It can only thus exist in thought, not in reality. In reality, the nebula only exists because it is inhabited by a number of spiritual beings. For when this nebula again became visible, there were connected with it all the beings who had once inhabited ancient Saturn, who had then passed through the various stages of evolution, through sun and moon, right on up to Earth. When, after a long intermediate pause, the Earth nebula arose, so to speak. The other beings also, with whom we became acquainted on the sun, were connected with this nebula. It was the whole choir of these beings who filled the nebula, who produced the movements, for beings create their field of work. For example, there were beings who needed a dwelling place quite different from that of man, if they were to undergo the evolution suited to them. The men who lived upon the ancient moon, as the ancestors of present man, had only physical, etheric, and astral bodies. With these three members of their being, they re-emerged from the so-called pralaya again, like a plant from a seed. At the beginning, the system was unsuitable for the beings who had brought with them the germs for the present man. Had the speed of development been maintained, which our solar system had at the beginning, when it came forth from the cosmic twilight, man would have been unable to find the path of his evolution. It would have resembled being born 1 minute and then almost immediately growing old. If the speed of evolution natural to the sun had been maintained, you would all rapidly grow old. You would be unable to take your slow course through the decades as you now actually do. After a short time, you would have white hair. You would be old almost before being a child. But this was not to be. There were beings who needed a quicker tempo. These only went through a part of evolution with man. Then they took out the heavenly body which now stands as the sun in the heavens and made it their dwelling place. They drew out the substance of the sun together with their own being. For the sun which sends its light to us today is inhabited by spiritual beings, just as our earth is. With every sunbeam descending to the earth come the deeds of those spiritual beings who in the course of the evolutions of Saturn, sun, and moon had progressed so far that they are able to participate in the rapid development taking place on the present sun. High, exalted beings were connected with this sun existence at the beginning of our earth development. These separated from the earth, and what then remained, you must imagine as if you had mixed together the present moon and earth in a great cauldron, after which this mingled earth and moon circled round the sun for a time. Thus, before we reach the point described yesterday as human incarnation, we have first to recognize the separation of the sun from the earth, that is, the present earth plus the present moon. Upon the sun remain the beings who are the spiritual directors of earthly events. When they came over from the ancient moon, there were 7 such beings. In Genesis, they are called Elohim, spirits of light. For a time they went through their evolution together with the earth. Then they drew forth the sun, so that they could now work upon the earth from the sun. These Elohim, these spirits of light, were 7 in number. 6 of them united their existence with the actual cosmic sun, and one, known in the Old Testament as Yahweh, separated from them and remained at first united with the earth. He guided and directed the earthly evolution from within, while the others worked upon it from without. That was the position for a time. But after what was pointed out yesterday concerning the ancient moon, you will understand that with the withdrawal of the sun was connected a condensation of all that remained as earth plus moon. There came a period in the earth's evolution when not only the substance, but all beings underwent a coarsening. For example, the beings who later became man, who at that time were very soft and delicate, underwent a coarsening through taking on horrible instincts. A coarsening of all life took place. Evolution could not remain thus if the human being was to arise. A coarsening would have taken place. Everything would have become more and more dense, and man would have stiffened into mummies. They would have become mummified. And there would very soon have been a planet upon which something not exactly beautiful, mummies resembling men like statues, would have collected. The earth would have become mummified. A different event had to take place. Through the government of Yahweh, the cosmic spirit, what you now see as the moon, as the burnt-out moon dross in the heavens, was separated from the whole mass of earth plus moon. Not only were the grossest substances separated, but also the grossest beings. Hence, through the withdrawal of the sun, it was brought about that man did not proceed too quickly in his evolution, and through the withdrawal of the moon it was brought about that he did not develop toward a condition of drying up, densification, or mummification. Thus the earth was separated from the whole mass, and now the course of man's evolution was guided on the earth under the influence of these 2 heavenly bodies, that is, of course, of their beings, the 6 sun spirits, and the moon spirit, who had detached himself for the salvation of man. And it is so guided that on the whole these 2 forces are balanced. Through the exit of both the sun forces and the moon forces, exactly the right tempo for man's development was attained. Now, in order to understand this more clearly, imagine men as if influenced only by the sun. You know that they go through their evolution upon the earth in many, many incarnations. They began with their first incarnation, then took on a new body over and over again, until one day they will go through their last incarnation. They pass through a series of incarnations, as a result of which they develop slowly and rise from one incarnation to the next. Men trod the surface of our earth as true spiritual infants. Since the separation of the sun and moon from our earth, they have risen to the present stage. All these souls will return in different bodies up to the end of the earth's evolution. Now, if man were influenced by the sun alone, he would have to pass in a single incarnation through all that he now goes through in so many. The right tempo comes into the many incarnations through the balancing of the forces between the sun and moon from without. Modern man was gradually shaped during the period when sun and moon withdrew. The first germs of the present-day man were then created. That was at a time when man moved upon this earth not at all as he does now. You must not imagine that when the moon had just gone forth, man moved upon this earth in a fleshly form as he does now. There appear first all the forms which had previously been there as a repetition. And when the earth was liberated from the sun and moon, it looked approximately like the old moon, even softer. And if a being with eyes organized like those of the present day had looked at the earth, he would not yet have been able to see man. On the other hand, certain other beings were there who were not sufficiently mature to await a later time. These had to take bodily form while the stage of evolution was still incomplete. So that sometime after the moon's departure from the earth, certain forms of the lower animals could already be seen physically condensed. Man had not yet descended, nor yet the higher mammals. Man was still a spirit being. He floated as a spirit round the earth and took into himself the finest substances from the environment of the earth. Then gradually he densified so far that he could descend to where the earth had already become solid and islands had formed. Thus we see that the first men appeared comparatively late in the earth's evolution, and at that time they had a very different constitution from the present man. I cannot describe to you the forms of those men which first crystallized, so to speak, out of the spirit. Although you have already heard much that is difficult to believe, you would be too greatly shocked if I were to describe to you the grotesque forms of the bodies in which our souls were then incarnated. You would not be able to bear such a description. However, at a later date, when these things, which are only now beginning to come to the consciousness of man through anthroposophy, when they more and more penetrate men's consciousness, this will have to be made known, and it will have a tremendous result. It will be extremely important to the whole life of man. For only when man learns how his body has developed, how the organs he now possesses have gradually developed out of entirely different forms, will he feel that remarkable relationship existing between the organs in the human body, which today are apparently far apart. He will then see the correspondence between certain organs, for example, between the appendix and the windpipe, which in their earlier form grew together in those remarkably formed beings. All that today is man is the previous form unrolled, as it were, the previous form unfolded in the most varied ways. Organs which today are separated formerly grew together. They have, however, kept their relationship. And very frequently this relationship is manifested in illnesses. It is seen that when a certain organ is diseased, another one becomes diseased in consequence. Hence, those who really study medicine will have to make many discoveries of which present-day medicine, which is only a collection of notes, does not dream. Then only will physicians really learn something about the true nature of man. All this is merely to point out how entirely different was man's earlier form. The solid parts were only built into this human form gradually. There were originally no bones in the human body, even when it had already descended. The bones developed out of soft, cartilaginous structures, which traversed the human body like cords. These, in their turn, originated from quite soft substances, and these soft substances from fluid substances, these from airy, the airy from etheric, and the etheric from astral, which had densified from spiritual substantiality. If you trace it back, you will find that everything material has originated from the spiritual. Everything is in archetype in the spiritual world. It was only in the Atlantean epoch that the bones, formerly merely indicated, actually developed in man. We must now more closely examine this Lemurian mankind, in order the better to understand the writer of the Apocalypse. I need only indicate that following the first period, when the moon had separated from the earth and man descended, he was of a very different nature as regards his will power from what he became later. At that time the will of man worked magically. By his will he could work upon the growth of flowers. When he exerted his will, he could make a flower shoot up quickly, a capacity which can only be acquired today by an abnormal process of development. Hence, at that time, the natural surroundings depended upon how the will of man was constituted. If it was good, it worked soothingly upon the billowing waters, upon the storm, and upon the fiery structures which were then all around, for the earth was to a great extent of a volcanic nature. Man worked soothingly upon all this through a good will, and destructively through an evil will. Thus man's will was in complete correspondence with its environment. The tracts of land upon which man then lived were destroyed essentially by the evil will of man, and only a small part of mankind was saved. We have again here to distinguish between race development and soul development. The part that lived on into our epoch, which we may describe properly, because in our language we can now find words that are adequate for the depiction of what clairvoyant consciousness perceives. After this catastrophe, we come to the ancient Atlantean epoch, when the race of mankind developed essentially on a continent which now forms the bed of the Atlantic Ocean, between the present Europe and America. At that time, man lived under very different physical conditions. At the beginning of the Atlantean epoch, he was a structure which perceived in quite a different way from the present man. We have already indicated this in the first lecture and again later. Today we shall again point out this different kind of vision of the man of that epoch. He still had a kind of spiritual vision, because the construction of his body was different from what it is now. The etheric body was not yet so firmly bound up with the physical body. The etheric body of the head extended far beyond the physical body. Only toward the last third of the Atlantean epoch did the projecting etheric body draw in and take the form of the present physical human head. Since the form of the ancient Atlanteans was so very different from that of present man, and his members so differently joined together, his whole life of consciousness, his whole soul life, was also different. And here, if we wish to understand the Apocalyptist, we must touch upon a very important but a very mysterious chapter. If you were to enter this ancient Atlantis, you would find that it was surrounded not by such pure air as the present earth, but by air saturated with volumes of mist, with water. This air became clearer and more transparent the further Atlantis developed. But the mists were densest where the more advanced Atlantean civilization referred to developed. The thickest mists were there, and from these developed the foundations of the later cultures. Atlantis was covered far and wide by these mists. A division of rain and sunshine, such as we have today, did not then exist. Hence in ancient Atlantis what you know as the rainbow could not appear. You might search the whole of Atlantis, and you would hardly find it. Only when the condensation of the water led to flooding, when the great flood spread itself over the earth, could the rainbow come into being physically. And this is a point where, from spiritual science, you will gain the greatest respect for the religious records. For when you are told that after the flood Noah, the representative of those who then saved mankind, sees the rainbow first appear, this is really an historical event. After the flood, mankind saw the first rainbow. Previously, it was an impossibility, simply from the point of view of physics. Here you will see how profound, how literally true the religious records are. Today many are distressed when one says that the religious records are literally true. Many quote a saying which is true. It is quoted, however, by lazy people, not as a true statement, but from indolence. It is the saying, "The letter killeth, but the spirit giveth life." From this they deduce the right to take no notice at all of what stands in the records, to have no longer the will to recognize what is actually there, for it is the dead letter, they say. And so they like to let their spirit shine and concoct all sorts of fantasies. These persons may indeed be very clever in their explanations, but that is not the point. The point is that we ought really to see in the records what is contained in them. Quote, "The letter killeth, but the spirit giveth life," close quote, has the same significance in mystical language as the saying of Goethe, quote, "If you have not this in you, die, and then become again. You are but a somber guest on earth's dark and gloomy plain." Close quote. This saying does not mean, if you wish to lead someone to a higher knowledge, you must slay him. It means that just through the culture of the physical world, man must uplift himself to spirituality. So also the letter is the body of the spirit, and we must first have and understand the letter, then we may say that we can find the spirit in it. The letter, the understood letter, must then die, so that the spirit may be resurrected from it. This saying is not an injunction to fancy anything you please about what is contained in the religious records. When we recognize the true significance of this rainbow as we have represented it, something like deep respect for the religious records imbues our soul, and we gain an idea of how, through the deepening of understanding by the teachings of anthroposophy, man first attains a true and genuine feeling for the religious documents, and a true understanding for them in the will. We will now look back into ancient Atlantis. We have already said that man then lived in a different state of consciousness, and that his memory was different from what it is now, but the difference is much more considerable. If we go far back, not merely into the later period of Atlantis, but to the beginning, we find the human consciousness very different from what we possess today. Let us once more consider the present consciousness. During the day, a person uses his senses. At night, he goes to sleep. In his bed lie the physical body and the etheric body. The astral body and the ego withdraw. The sphere of consciousness darkens. The man of today sees nothing and hears nothing. Then, again, in the morning, when the astral body and the ego re-enter the physical body and etheric body, physical objects once more confront him. How was it in the early Atlantean epoch? Let us take the moment when, in the morning, man plunged into the physical and etheric bodies. At that time, he did not have a physical world around him such as we have today. All the present objects, which are now seen with clear outlines, were then seen as if surrounded with an aura, with colored edges, quite indistinctly. In ancient Atlantis, the appearance was somewhat similar to what is now seen when in the evening there is a dense fog, and you see the street lamps not clearly, but surrounded by colored edges. Thus it was in early Atlantis. All objects were seen indistinctly, not with clear outlines and surfaces as today. Everything was as if enveloped in colored mist. Only gradually have clear outlines developed. Had we looked at a rose in the first part of Atlantis, it would have been as if a cloudy structure arose with a red disk in the middle. Only gradually did the external color appear to be laid on the surface. Only later did objects obtain sharp outlines. Hence you see that the physical world surrounding man was quite different in ancient Atlantis. It was also different when at night he rose out of his physical body, when, shall we say, he went to sleep. Really, it was not sleep in the present sense. The entire world of the misty physical formations remained below, and a spiritual world arose. Possessing no sharp outlines, man lived within a spiritual world, Spiritual beings were his companions. In the first portion of the Atlantean epoch, day and night alternated in such a way that when man plunged into his physical body, he had only hazy, indistinct pictures of the physical world. But when at night he left the physical body, he was able to live spiritually, although somewhat indistinctly, among spirits. He moved among spirits. And above all, man's entire life of feeling was also different in the Atlantean epoch. At that time, when he went out of his physical body and etheric body, he did not feel fatigue and the need for rest. Neither did he find rest. He had to enter into the spiritual world. That was then his sphere of activity. On the other hand, when the morning came, he felt the need for rest and sought out his resting place, which was his own body. There he lay peacefully. He crept into his own body and rested during the day. Thus, in the first period of Atlantis, it was entirely different from what it is now. During the Atlantean epoch, man gradually passed from the very opposite conditions into those of the later period. This came about more and more as the etheric body was driven into the physical body. This occurred during the last third of the Atlantean epoch. Before this event, man felt himself as a waking being above in the spiritual world, but as such he did not say to himself, I. He did not possess consciousness of self. When he withdrew from his physical and etheric bodies in order to go into the brilliance of the night, he felt himself to be a member of the spirituality which was above. He felt himself safely protected, so to speak, in his group soul. It always became bright around him during the night, but he felt himself dependent. Just as our finger belongs to our ego, so man felt that he belonged to the group souls, which are seen spiritually as the four heads of the lion, eagle, bull, and man, described in the Apocalypse of John. Man felt himself transposed into one such group soul. And only when snail-like he was in his bodily shell did he feel that he possessed something of his own. For the circumstance that man became an independent being resulted from his being able to envelop himself in his body. He had, however, to pay for this confinement in his body by the gradual obscuration of the spiritual world, until it completely withdrew. In its place, the world which he saw below when he was in the physical body became brighter and clearer. In this way it gradually dawned upon him that he was an ego, that he had consciousness of self within him. He learned to say I to himself. If we wish to characterize what took place at that time, we must imagine man creeping out of his snail shell, as it were, into the spiritual world. There he was among spiritual divine beings. There resounds to him from without the name of what he is. One group heard the word which in the original language was the word for that group. Another group heard a different word. Man could not name himself from within. His name sounded into him from without. When he thus crept out of the snail shell of his body, he knew what he was, because this knowledge was intoned into his soul. Now when, in his body, he learned to perceive the physical environment, he learned to feel himself as I. He learned to feel within himself the divine power which previously intoned into him. He learned to feel God within him. The God nearest to him, who pointed to his ego, he called Yahweh. This God was the ego leader, and man felt the power of this God arising within his ego. External events were connected with this. When the ancient Atlantean thus descended into his physical body and looked out into space, he did not see an actual rainbow. In the place where the sun later emerged, he saw something like a circle formed of color. The sun did not yet penetrate in power, but acted through the mist. Though hindered and held back by the fog, its forces influenced the earth. It appeared very gradually. Thus all that we have described as the awakening of external consciousness was connected with the emergence of the sun from the mist. What was up above, where the six other spirits had their abode, who together with Yahweh had to guide the earth evolution, gradually emerged and shone down upon the earth in deeds. What had taken place in man? When, previously, he rose out of his body, when it was night, so to speak, his soul and spirit entered into the inner astral brilliance for which the external sun is not necessary. This brilliance surrounded him. It was the same light from mighty spiritual beings, which later shone down physically from the sun. As he gradually enclosed himself more and more in his physical consciousness, the door of inner vision was closed. Darkness surrounded him when at night he left his physical and etheric bodies and entered the spiritual world. To the extent to which he confined himself, to the same extent arose the external light, which represents the deeds of the spiritual beings of the sun. The light of the spiritual beings shone externally upon the earth. Man prepared himself to look upon the external light as something material. The light shone in his then darkened inner being, but the light was not then comprehended by his darkness. This is a world historical cosmic event. Man bought his consciousness of self at that time through spiritual darkening. In this way, man grew away from the brilliance of the group souls. But it was only the very first dawning of the individuality. It was a long, long time before he really grew possessed of it. The last portion of the Atlantean epoch passed away, and the flood came. The post-Atlantean epoch began. The ancient Indian culture passed away. True consciousness of self had not yet developed. Then came the Persian and the Babylonian-Egyptian ages. Man gradually matured so as to develop consciousness of self within him. At length came the fourth age. At this stage, something of tremendous importance took place for which all that had gone before was the preparation. Imagine yourself now uplifted from the earth to a distant star and gifted with clairvoyant vision, looking down to the earth from that distant star. You would then see that this earth's physical body is only a physical body, and that an etheric body and an astral body belongs to it, just as with man. The earth has all this too. You would see the earth surrounded by its aura, and from that star you would be able to follow the development of the earth's aura for thousands of years. You would see this earth surrounded by all sorts of colors. In the center, the physical kernel, and around it the aura floating in various forms and colors. And in this spiritual atmosphere of the earth, you would see the most varied structures. You would see these colors and forms change in various ways in the course of millennia. But there would come a moment of great importance, when the whole aura assumes a different form and color. Seen from outside, the earth then appears in a new light. And this takes place extremely quickly, so that one has to say, from this moment a fundamental transformation of the earth has taken place. Its aura has changed completely. When is this moment? It is the moment when upon Golgotha the blood flowed from the wounds of the Redeemer. This moment is an extremely important one, the most important moment in the whole of the earth's evolution. The moment when the blood flows from the wounds of the Redeemer is the same as that in which the aura of the earth shapes itself anew. An entirely new power enters in, the power which gives the most important impulse to the evolution of earth, for which all that we have considered up to now was only the preparation. To the chemist, the blood of Golgotha is the same as any other blood, but in reality it is quite different. It signifies that the substance of the blood flows down to the earth, and that the spirit, corresponding to it, fills the aura of the earth with new impulses and new forces which have significance for the future evolution of mankind. From there the forces which change the earth stream forth. From there they stream through man. Only a small part of what flowed in at that moment has been realized up to now. Ever more and more man will learn to understand what the earth has become through that moment of Golgotha, and what man can develop toward in that consciousness which he has gained since Atlantis. What then has man gained since Atlantis? Two things: ego consciousness and the faculty of sight in the external world. What was previously open to him, the spiritual world, has been closed. Truly, these earlier men saw what the later myths relate: Woden, Mercury, Jupiter, Zeus. They saw all these beings at night. They were then among them. The door to these spiritual beings has closed. In their place, man has gained the world now surrounding him. The spirits have withdrawn from him. All that he was able to see at that time has disappeared. Formerly, he saw the divine when he slipped out of the snail shell of his physical body. He had now to see the divine within the body, if it was to appear before him. This means nothing else than that we must receive the divine in bodily, physical shape, because human consciousness has become adapted to physical vision. And for this reason, the divine itself had to assume bodily, physical form. Therefore, the divine appeared on the earth in a fleshly body, once in the evolution of time. It had to appear in this form, because man had advanced to this stage of perception. It had to be presented in this way to his perception, so that he could understand it. And all the appearances which had previously taken place at other stages of evolution had to be united in that greatest event in the earth's history, which will throw light on the whole future, and which we shall now unveil from the apocalypse. In that event, which physically looks as if drops of blood stream down to the earth, but spiritually as if something rises up, which changes the aura of the earth, the force which then flowed in will work together with the earth throughout the whole future. The earth soul, the spirit of the whole earth, was then inoculated with something new. The Christ principle united with the earth at that time, and the earth has become the body of this Christ principle. So that the statement is literally true: he who eats my bread treads me underfoot. When man eats the bread of the earth, he eats the body of the earth, and this is the body of the earth spirit, which, as the Christ spirit, since the event on Golgotha, is united with the earth. And man walks upon the earth body. He treads this body underfoot. All can be understood literally, if only we are able first of all to comprehend the text in the right way. To such a man as the writer of John's Gospel, all that he knew, all that he could grasp with spiritual vision, was a summons to understand the greatest event in the earth's evolution. Of all that he was able to learn through spiritual vision, he said, "I must use it in order to understand Christ and his work." It was the intention of the writer of the Apocalypse to use all his occult knowledge in order to explain the event of Golgotha. Whatever he could learn from occult science was regarded by him as wisdom, serving to help him understand this event, which he has placed before us in such a wonderful way, and regarding which we shall see what it signified for him. The end of Lecture 6.